All right, well, I think we're ready. Good morning, everyone. Good to see you all here today. Glad to share this Palm Sunday space with you. Hey, speaking of today, which is Palm Sunday, don't forget to grab your palm frond out front before service starts, because we participate with that first century crowd that welcomes Jesus into Jerusalem, and we will have our palm fronds flying today. So please make sure to grab your palm fronds before the 10:30 hour. What's that? Yes, it's difficult to say that out loud. Okay. And I think there's plenty out there for all of us to have one. So by all means, grab one. We'll fly them together. And we will bring Scripture into the present by participating with Scripture today. Also, if you think of it, it may be worthwhile to have people sit in this third row, because I think almost that entire row is traveling this weekend. So like, you know, if you're a I sit in my spot every week person, which several of you are not, you move around. But if you are, maybe adjust a little bit, because there's going to be an entire row of no people, because they're all traveling in various places. You know, you notice that in our small congregation. Okay. Well, let's reflect a little bit and talk a little together on the politics of hope. We'll do this week, and then next week we'll just sort of sum up some stuff. And then move into other stuff after Easter. But there are a couple things I want to talk about with you still. And so we'll start with this. We can just hear it. Next week we'll share words back on this verse. But today we'll just hear it. You don't have to share a word back. But 1 Peter 1:3, you know, our ministry theme for the year has several things in it that connect to this notion of the politics of hope. So just here, receive this passage. Maybe we'll let it be the lens through which we discuss all that we talk about today. So 1 Peter 1:3. By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. By God's great mercy, God has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Okay, next week we'll reflect on that just a little bit together, but this week we'll move forward. So here's a claim that the politics of hope makes, and it's significant for reflecting on the like practical application. What do you do in this particular politics? So here's a claim that the politics of hope makes, and it's significant. The claim is this: God chooses to build God's future through you and me. God chooses to build God's future through you and through me. Meaning this, hope is not just a future-oriented thing. It does have a future component, absolutely. But it is not merely a future-oriented thing. Hope is a future-oriented thing that impacts the present. What we do now, this is that line from Gladiator, echoes into eternity. Yeah, what we do now is the building of God's kingdom to come. For whatever reason, it doesn't make any sense. It's very vulnerable of God to do this. But God says, I'm going to take what you do today. Let's say you write a poem, or sing a song. I'm going to take what you do today, and I'm going to use that to build the new creation that is coming, such that what we do now is, in fact, the construction of the kingdom to come. Now, it's not here in its fullness, right? It's not totally here, the new creation where justice reigns finally. That's not totally here. But what we do today is meant to be the building blocks of what is to come. What we do in the present lasts into the future. So our question in the politics of hope, in this particular way of living in the world, our question is continually, how can I help bring about the kingdom of God in whatever task is right before me? I probably should put that on the screen. How can I bring about the kingdom of God in whatever task is right before me? That's the constant guiding question that the politics of hope, this way of organizing our community life, is going to ask of us. Now, we're going to come back to that and talk about, okay, let's say out loud, how can I do that? We're going to talk about that in just a second. But I think so. I think there's a slide later today. I can't remember. I think so. I think I put it up there. But anyway, when you answer that, how can I help bring about the kingdom of God in whatever task is right before me? When you're answering that, you're already answering the question, what do I do? What does the politics of hope look like in my daily life? Whatever the answer to that first question is the answer to the second question. Okay, we're going to come back to that. I'm just introducing it here. Okay, but here's the problem with the politics of hope. We've hinted at this, but let me just make it explicit. Here's the problem with this particular politics. Like you might look at, I don't know, Italian politics and say, well, here's the problem with Italian politics. And you would list a few things, right? Here's the problem with Canadian politics, and you'd list a few things. Here's the problem with Scottish politics, and you'd list a few things. Here's the problem with the politics of hope, God's politics. There's two problems. One, it just seems so foolish and weak to live out this way, it's hard to really believe we're supposed to do this. You know, take something simple like Jesus says, hey, I don't want you just to forgive 7 times. I want you to forgive 70 times 7 times. It doesn't feel like that makes sense in life. Like it's hard to imagine living that way. I can't just forgive everyone indiscriminately. That doesn't make sense, right? And there's some nuance to it, but the problem is with the politics of hope, this way of living, it feels foolish and it feels weak. Like the way of the cross, as Paul said, is foolish and weak to those outside of it. So that's one big problem, like getting our mind around that, getting our hearts around it, like really trusting, if I live this way, it's actually good and right and effective in some cosmic way, even if it's not effective right now. So there's one problem. Here's the second problem. This is maybe even the bigger problem. The politics of hope, living this way, and again, we'll discuss some of the ways that we live, but living this way, it seems so small and insignificant in the light of national and global realities. It does. The politics of hope, like when Jesus was preaching and people were getting so excited, and they said, hey, let's take this guy, and they said, by force, and make him the king of Israel. And Jesus had to run away from them, basically. He dismissed them and runs away from them and hides in the desert by himself in the hills. Because they were saying, no, what you're doing seems great, Jesus, but it's small. It's sort of insignificant. No one in Rome even knows you're doing anything here. And you can feel that in today's world. Like, I want to know what to do that will make a difference to, like, so-called third world debt. Like, how do I make a difference, right? That's big, significant. The politics of hope, although it does want to address stuff like that, doesn't begin there. The politics of hope begins on a much smaller level. It feels insignificant. The fact is, nobody outside Israel had ever heard of Jesus. He felt small and insignificant. That is just the reality, right? Later on, everyone in the world heard of him. But early on, He was small and insignificant. The politics of hope can feel that way as well. So that if our mindset is politics is about big, world-changing, significant things, we'll constantly find ourselves asking, I don't know what to do. Because honestly, what can you do about global debt? You personally can do probably nothing. You're powerless to do anything about that. I mean, you can do small things, right? But no big thing. We're not in charge. We don't have that type of power. So if we're thinking in terms of politics has to be about big and significant things, it can be, of course. But if that's all it is, it will just be hard to accept the politics of hope. It'll seem weak, foolish, small, and insignificant. Just like Jesus seemed to his contemporaries weak and foolish and small and insignificant, and yet saved the world. So we have to sort of get our minds around this notion that the politics of hope, the way that Jesus calls us to, the way that God calls us to through Christ, is actually divinely powerful even when it doesn't seem like it. Last week we mentioned, for example, what Gandhi did in India, standing up to the British people. Plenty of Gandhi's contemporaries critiqued him. His way seemed foolish, right? You don't just walk up to the British and let them club you with their little batons. You know, remember they wanted to go get salt out of the ocean, right? But the Brits weren't letting them do that. So they just walked up to the seashore and they hit them over the head and they fell down. And then the next person up just walked up and they hit them again. And the next person just walked and they just kept doing it. And Gandhi said, don't fight back. Just do this. Love these people and just keep walking up to there. And then eventually it actually changed their nation, right? It seemed foolish and insignificant and people complained about it. Same with Martin Luther King, right? He leads this movements that plenty of people critiqued and said, it doesn't make sense. You cannot act nonviolently and make a difference in this world. It seemed foolish and insignificant. And yet, it was divinely powerful. So, if we can get our minds around the fact that Jesus' cross, which was foolish and weak and small and insignificant, was actually divinely powerful, had the power of the resurrection behind it, then we might be able to start imagining, okay, if these small things are in fact divinely, cosmically significant, maybe doing them is in fact our calling. Maybe we can live out this politics that seems impossible and small and insignificant in the face of world issues and national issues. But we have to begin by getting our minds around the fact politics isn't simply about large and significant, big, huge things. So we have to sort of start there. But if we can, we may just discover that the politics of hope is actually active resistance to the things that trouble us most in this world. Okay, that's all introductory stuff. Let's talk specifics here. The reason I say all that is I want to talk specifics, but I don't want us to be paralyzed into thinking, well, I don't know what to do because the only thing I can think of are so big, I don't have the power to do anything about it. I want to free us up from that and say even small things like going to a cross can in fact be divinely powerful in the politics of hope. Okay, so how do we do this? Here's where we ended last week. I said, begin with what we do on Sundays. So practically, how do we live out the politics of hope? And my suggestion was, we'll just start with what we do on Sunday mornings. Think about our regular rhythm every week, which is meant to be in microcosm, an example of how we're meant to live all the time. So what do we do on Sunday mornings? For example, every once in a while we do baptisms right over here in our baptistry, right? What does that mean? Well, in baptism, we say things like, everyone is welcome to join us, regardless of race or gender or social class, right? Like when Paul says, those who are in Christ, there's no longer male or female. There's no longer slave or free. There's no longer rich or poor, Jew or Greek, right? There's no longer any of that. I mean, you still You still remain who you are, but it's not your fundamental identity. You are, in fact, connected to something bigger, a bigger identity. So in baptism, we say, you know, we're gonna connect and be united with all people. That's what we do on Sunday. Or like in confession, we confess. I'll go through these quickly because we already talked about them last week. Confession. In confession, we say we don't have it all figured out. We start, our politics starts by saying we've made plenty of mistakes. We've done things wrong. We know better now, so now we're going to try and do better. Every week we begin with confession. This politics confesses that it makes mistakes. Lord's Supper. Lord's Supper is a welcoming of all to a single table, sharing resources. It's a symbol of sharing resources, your food with all people, right? Sharing your bread and drink with all people. All are welcome to the table. Preaching, we say it matters how we speak. It matters that we try and speak truthfully, that is somehow divinely powerful. Prophets, we have multiple voices that speak every Sunday because we think all voices matter. So the Politics of Hope says all voices must matter the other days of the week. Tithing, we share our resources. We say, I have money, but it's just been entrusted to me to use for the good of our people. It's in my bank account, but the fact is, I share it with you. You share it with me, right? We share our money back and forth. We take care of one another. Tithing, we do that every single week. Or even just blessing. We stand up and our leaders bless us, right? They don't condemn us. They don't judge us. They bless us. They act with affection towards us, and we bless one another. It's a microcosm of how we're meant to live in the politics of hope. So here's what I want to ask. In the church, I was talking with Dan Dickinson after class last Sunday, and he said, you know, several of those are actually considered sacraments in the church, right? Sacraments just simply being human actions in which God is also involved. Sacraments. And it's true. These are sacramental actions. The entire politics of hope is sacramental. Human actions in which God is involved building the new creation. So here's my question. This I do want you to respond to. How would we live these things out in our lives? How would you practice baptism, the unity of all people regardless of social class, gender, race, whatever? How would you practice confession or tithing? How do you practice some of these in our daily lives? How can we live out these sacraments every day? Can you think of examples that aren't literally baptism, but the spirit of baptism in our lives? Not literally the Lord's Supper, but the spirit of what the Lord's Supper is about, welcoming all people to a single table. How do we live that out in our daily lives? Can you think of any examples? Let's see if we can think of a few instead of me just telling you what they are. I may do that as well, but let's see if we can think of a few. Yeah, Melinda. Melinda. As a reminder for those on Zoom, hold the mic up real close, otherwise I can't hear it.
I don't have the answer for all of them for anybody else. I know for me, I've been really reflecting on the confession aspect for a while now. And so I've taken our prayer of confession and I've rewritten it in a way that for a long time at work we did land acknowledgments. And I was feeling a little awkward about the land acknowledgments because it was feeling just like words. It wasn't feeling like we were actually doing
right.
it. We
like
were checking
those
a
things
box.
Can, right.
We were checking a box. So I was thinking about confession and land acknowledgments, and I started crafting my own confession of this is a broken world that is racist, that is othering, that is, and just kind of rewrote it. And so when I'm starting my work day or I'm starting a training or I'm starting a coaching, I start it with that and I will publicly read it or I just read it to myself, of keeping that mindset of the system that I am a part of is broken and has harmed people. And whether I did the harm or not, I'm still part of this system.
Okay.
And so I think for me, that has helped me keep that in the forefront.
Right, right. So practicing confession in your work setting, where you're acknowledging, hey, some of the things we're doing here have actually been harmful and ineffective and hurtful to people. At the same time, I'm going to say that out loud, and now I'm going to try and do it better, just like we do in practice of the prayer of confession every Sunday. I've often thought this. Wouldn't it be wonderful if every book you ever read, maybe not all novels, maybe novels too, though, but particularly theology or philosophy or things like that, what if they all started off by saying, I may be wrong about this? What if that was the first sentence of every book? I may be wrong about this. And then the second sentence was, and I know that because I've been wrong so many times before. And then the third sentence was, because I suspect in 5 years I may think a little bit differently, because I know 5 years ago I thought differently. What if every book began that way? What if that was the way we practice the organization of life together? I parent by saying to my children, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm pretty sure I'm going to make mistakes. I'm pretty sure I've already made mistakes. And when I make mistakes, I'm going to tell you, I made a mistake. What if that's how we organized life? Confession. Okay, Jen and then Jeff.
Excuse me. Tithing pretty directly, charitable contributions to other organizations. I mean, we've got a list of places that we donate to in addition to East County. There's, places that we give our money to and places that we volunteer to regularly that are important to us.
Right.
And then the Lord's Supper, I think there's, we have in our home, people come and sit around our table and we share life with them. And it happens numerous times throughout the year and all are welcome. And sometimes they are our friends. Sometimes they are friends of our friends. Sometimes they're people, and like that, that's a pretty straightforward translation of those.
That is it's great. Tithing, it presumes your money is not yours. Ultimately, it's sort of under your supervision and stewardship, but it's not yours. Tithing presumes this belongs to God ultimately. And so we share it. I mean, you're the steward of it, but you share it because it's not yours. It's a way of organizing the spending of money that is different from other politics in this world. Or even just, like you say, the Lord's Supper. I'm just imagining what it was like my junior high school, Sacagawea Junior High School. Everyone ate lunch at the same time. There was this huge cafeteria, right? Massive cafeteria. One of those weird places where there's so many people, you feel alone, right? You feel alone because there's so many people. And you walk into that space, and you knew this is where the athletes sit. And, and this is where the drama people sit because they're weird, And then this is where those people who, are quiet, they sit or whatever. And you can imagine how wonderful it would be if seventh graders were so shaped by the politics of hope, by the politics of the church, that they try to do what Jen describes that they do in their home every year, right? Like, how wonderful would that be if we're structuring our lives that way? And then, at potlucks, we try and do the same thing. We don't just sit with just the people we're closest to. We try and have a table that's open to all, right? And then you expand that out just a little bit into the workplace, where, again, it's so easy to form cliques in your workplace, right? There's people you like, people you don't like. But the Lord's Supper teaches us, well, maybe we invite others into our clique in that sense. So again, simple ways in which you can sort of live this out. That's the politics of hope. Jeff?
I was reminded just in my past where, I would say things and then for a long time and then realize, oh, you know what? That's probably not a good thing to say, or I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That was dumb. Well, if I had started out saying I may be wrong, I wouldn't have that feeling like I need to justify myself.
Right, okay.
And I could just say, oh, yeah, well, I guess I was wrong, okay.
Yeah, I may be wrong. Turned out, my prediction was right. I was wrong. You know, like you sort of, yeah. So again, that's practicing confession in a daily way of just approaching life and faith and politics and family relations and work relations and theology. It's a way of organizing our community around confessing you might be wrong. Okay, Carrie, then Jen.
Well, I like our little blessing people through the week.
Mm.
You know, it's a way to get out of our little cocoon. I mean, you get so wrapped up in what's going on with you, and then you bring out that paper and it's like, it's Roger.
Yeah, right.
You know, I need to think about someone other than me.
Yes. What a great point. Part of the blessing is that it's personal. It's intimate. And so we say, you look on your little prayer sheet and you're on the Curtis family. And today it's Roger and Debbie. May the God of mercy who raised Christ from the dead grant you new birth into a living hope. There's a spirit of blessing that's personal and intimate, right? Attentive affection. But then you extrapolate that out further, right? You're driving on the road. And that annoying person on Stark Street who cuts you off, right, or whatever, or, you know, everyone else is merging except for this one person who's not merging and cutting in front of everyone, right? And you say, may the God of hope and peace grant you new birth, you know, into a living hope or something like that, right? You offer up blessing when the response is to offer up cursing. Again, I don't just mean it for us personally. I mean organizing our entire life around blessing. What would it do to a people to organize your entire life around blessing instead of cursing others? It's a different way of organizing, and therefore it results in very different ways. Like imagine, you know, the boss who says, well, I'm a Christian, I'm part of the politics of hope, God's politics, therefore, however I talk to all of my employees must be fundamentally based in blessing. It has to be based in blessing. It would change the way we organize our lives. As opposed to saying, well, yes, I do that on Sunday, but it's not practical at work. I do that in church. I do that with my friends, but it's not practical in real life. Politics of hope says, who says it's not practical? It's like the cross isn't practical, and yet it saves the world. Maybe we try it. Jen?
When I think about baptism and the Lord's Supper as both spaces where we say, you know, everyone is welcome.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what, it makes me think of working at a check lane at Target, and that no matter what their socioeconomic status or their race, that what I give them is a respectful and loving and caring space, you know, mm-hmm. in that 5 minutes, you know.
Right.
It's the same.
Yes, that's a great example. You know how difficult it is, even in a church setting, to get out of the habit of attending very carefully and attentively to the well-dressed, well-off person. Like, it's just so easy. You know, like a guest comes in, and they're well-dressed, and they have a lovely family, and it's just so easy to give them a great deal of attention. It's more difficult, even in a church setting, to offer that same attention you're describing to those who are just so different from us, right? So different from whatever the norm is in our minds. It's just so difficult. But the politics of hope says, well, what if we organize our community around teaching ourselves not to do that any longer? Not just whoever comes in church, but just every in the line at Target. You know, if you're the cashier at Target doing that, right? The politics of hope is saying these little things, these little ways of organizing your community, they're building the kingdom that is to come. Amy? I mean, sorry, two people at once, and it came out as Amy, Wendy, Melinda.
I've been called worse.
Yeah.
I was thinking probably the most difficult one to figure out is preaching, just because in my head it requires words. And then last week you quoted, I can't remember who it was that said, show by your actions was the gist of it. Show, it, you may have to use words, but don't if you don't have to.
Right, right, yes.
And I think that there's something huge in that. People notice when your life is different and when the way you're approaching life is different.
Yeah, that's good. So the preaching part that can be just preaching with a life, of course, not simply with words, right, which can get nerve-wracking when you're thinking, do I have the right words? And I think also with preaching, preaching says, look, I'm committed to trying to, all of us are committed to trying to speak and hear truth even when it's uncomfortable for us. And think about what it'd be like if in every aspect of our life we didn't ever say half-truths. We said it matters that we try and hear truths even when they're hard and speak truths even when they're difficult. I mean, it's no problem when it's easy, of course. You look beautiful today. You know, no problem, right? but when it's difficult, that, you know, I think we easily default into organizing our life around, you know, there's certain situations where you probably just tell a half-truth here. And it'd be a lot easier. You're trying to get a refund from some place and you're returning the item and they say, well, did you open the box? And you say, no, I didn't open the box. You did, but you say you didn't, right? Or whatever. What would it mean if we all the time committed ourselves to, I want to hear the truth and I'm going to say the truth? What if we organized our community around that? That's part of what I think preaching calls us to as well. Melinda?
So when I was listening to Jen, made me think on Thursday, I got to the wonderful experience of spending 8 hours in the DNV on PAL. It was quite the experience, and there were lots of people helping people at the DNV.
Yeah.
And being very kind, and I saw lots of great customer service. Mm-hmm. And then finally, after I'd been sitting for 8 hours, my number finally got called. And the person who was helping me, it was different than what I had been witnessing from other people. And it wasn't until you were talking that I was like, so what was so different? Because it literally changed my entire experience from, like, why am I have to be here for 8 hours? Couldn't you guys think of a better way to do that? Like, all of the things, to the kindness and the warmth and the caring that went beyond good customer service, that made me walk away going, that had to be a person of peace, that had to be a person of God. And she didn't preach to me. She didn't proclaim to me, but she preached to me.
Right, right.
And so it's kind of like, there's a difference, I think, when we really have the mindset of this versus good customer service or good, you know, I can only imagine going through Jen's line and going, that was an amazing experience.
Right.
Like, I know if you have that mindset, it changes even if you're using the same words. And I don't know, it made me reflect on that of, there was a difference in her experience than when I went and asked a question or asked if I could do this. And other people were very helpful. She genuinely cared about me in that moment.
Yeah. So, we'll do Karen and then Amy. You could imagine that, you know, when we say hope is a present set of beliefs and actions based on a past event that promises a future reality. We have this future reality in our head. God's, as Jen put it last week, preferred and promised future. We have that in our heads. And we attempt in every little moment to embody that now. That's how we're going to organize our entire life together. So hope is present actions that build now the kingdom that is coming, which is exactly what you experienced at the DMV, a present set of behaving towards you that was building now what relationships will be like when the kingdom comes in its fullness. That's hope, And when we all do it, when we organize our life around it, it's a politics of hope. We organize our whole life around, in every moment, doing now what everyone will do when the kingdom comes in its fullness. Okay, Karen, Amy, then Jen.
This is one of those things I don't do, but Meryl does a great job of listening, especially to our neighbor who drives me around the bend with his politics and his views and stuff, but he listens to him. And he listens to him deeply, and then he presents a, have you thought about this, or a different perspective, or, you know, he's very gentle in presenting something in a different way. And honestly, I think preaching is the word that we have difficulty with, because it's sending something at somebody.
Yes, yes.
But he's really doing it.
Right.
And in a really more graceful way than I could possibly, so.
Yes, thanks for that. I love that. I love the example. And I think it's part of the reason that on this particular list, these aren't all the things we do on Sundays, of course, but preaching, right after it, it was important to put the word prophets. So preaching is usually just one person. It's usually just me talking at you guys, right? Prophets is all the other people who are involved in service, who get up, who are not under my control. They say what they're going to say. They offer what they think is beneficial for East County, based on where we're at and who we are. And we commit to listening to multiple voices every single week. We train ourselves to say, this service is incomplete if all you do is hear from Kevin. It's complete if you also hear from Carolyn and Donnie and Brian Rusher, to use today's people. If you hear from all of them, we train ourselves to say it matters that we listen to multiple voices. And then Meryl puts it into practice, right? Puts it into practice in his daily life by listening to this guy. Different voices, different thoughts than what he would have. What if we organized our entire life around the commitment to always listening to multiple voices? And then, of course, sharing back. That's the preaching part. Well, have you thought about this too, right? Sharing back. What if just maybe there's this way to think of it too? But we always commit ourselves. We organize our life committing ourselves to listen to multiple voices. That's our politics. What if we did that, right? Amy?
Just a couple things that came to my mind was...
That's not on.
Now it is.
Now okay. It is.
My dad is such a good man, and... also, my dad, right, can be annoying. Like, his hobby is talking on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, bro, bro, I don't have anything else new from yesterday.
Yeah.
I love you. But it is his way of saying, hey, you are important to me, and I love you, and I want you to feel blessed today.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. And that has really blessed me to think about, like, how he wants others to feel loved and blessed. Even on his Facebook messages of, like, happy birthday and blessings. Like, I can always tell it's dad typing and not mom, because they share an account, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
But so they are very different. But the other part is, well, when kids are acting the fool and I am able to keep my brain intact and not flip my lid back, the conversations that we have is like, I'm holding this space of accountability for you because I care about you and because I want you to be a blessing to others in the future. So, like, thinking about how I speak to students in those moments of, like, listen, you may not talk to people that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you end up in a job and you talk to somebody that way, you are going to be fired. Like, we are trying to break those habits early, like those kinds of things. Helps if I think about it as the politics of hope, that is easy for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
It takes my emotion out of it because it's not about what I'm feeling. It's about how can I be kingdom to this child right now who I want to potentially... No, I can't say that. I'd lose my teaching license. But, you know, like, sometimes I'm like, if you fall down the stairs, I'm not going to be mad. Like, I would be mad. You know what I mean? Like, those kinds of, like, oh, this kid.
Right.
But that is a person that God loves no matter what, and so I need to work on loving them with my words and my actions and my boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of, when I'm thinking about the blessing part of that, like, that is a blessing.
Right.
It may not be words of blessing. But then, like, we'll stop us, but in the long run, it
that was good. Thanks. Two things we didn't put on here. We didn't put prayer on here, but that's something we do every week. And prayer we might summarize as attentive affection, which your dad offers. It's a prayer. It's a you know he's offering you attentive affection. And we also didn't talk about here, you know, dealing with conflict, which is a thing we sometimes have to do on a Sunday, or certainly as a church, right? There's certain ways of dealing with conflict that matter to this way of organizing life that you're hinting at there as well. Okay, Jen.
There was a group that I got started with. They started during COVID, just online. They called themselves the Pink Ladies, based mm-hmm. after
yes.
The Grease group, because mm-hmm. they're cool.
Yeah.
And in essence, they asked people to put names of people who needed blessings into here, and then you know, share information, and then the other members of the Pink Ladies would, you know, sometimes it was just basically pray or send good thoughts. Sometimes people would send cards or other sorts of things, and it was in essence like we do here. It was, you know, sharing blessings and prayers and that sort of things. Sometimes it was, you know, like when I went and visited my mom this last fall, she was like, do you know who these Pink Ladies are? Are they part of your people? Mm-hmm. Because she was like, I got a ton of cards, and she got like blankets and gifts, and she was like, I don't know who they are, but I think maybe they're associated with
you. But they sound like you, Jen. Yeah.
And that sort of thing, and those, you know, those were blessings.
Right.
But what I was thinking as we were sitting here, the people who started that group, and most of the members of that group are not Christians. Mm-hmm. The gal who started it is very much an atheist. I know several of the members are Wiccans, and there are other folks in there. So I think that also we do this because we are Christians, mm-hmm. and this is how we are living our, you know, like the our hope. But I think we also need to be careful that we're not doing the sort of thing where we're like saying that we have a monopoly on this as Christians too.
Right.
So as part of the whole piece of this, that we live this as Christians, but that we also don't have a monopoly on it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we say to ourselves, here's why we do it, although it seems weak and small and insignificant. Here's why we do it. And then we see other people doing it for other reasons, and we rejoice. How wonderful that this kingdom, this new creation, is being built in places we hadn't anticipated. How lovely and wonderful. Shannon?
Basically, everything I've heard so far this morning, for me, pairs down to we just need to get rid of the get off my lawn attitude.
Really.
Because that covers all sorts
so
of
much
things.
Of it. Yeah.
Just the edge is like, stay away. Get off my lawn.
I mean,
it's okay. Come on.
Yes.
Walk on it, stomp on it, let's talk.
And there's also ways of talking about, in the politics of hope, in the kingdom, we're not just going to destroy the lawn either. So let's care for the lawn and be good stewards of the lawn. You know, there's that aspect of it as well. Okay, so all of this, it, on the one hand, can feel like just very personal. So you personally just go out and be nice to people. But it's more than that. The point here is saying we're going to organize our common life together in these ways. So that every time a question comes up for us and we say, should we as a community do this or that, we ask ourselves, well, is it consistent with our politics? Our politics that practice baptism, welcome people of all genders, races, ethnic, social class, etc. Is it consistent with confession? Admitting that, you know, sometimes we're wrong about stuff. In fact, we're going to continue to be wrong about stuff. Are we organizing our corporate life together in these ways? That's what the question of the politics of hope is saying. Not just about you being nice, which is great. Go and be nice, you know, in the line to kids, etc. Absolutely. But how can we as a community organize ourselves in these ways? So such that everything we do is geared towards building the kingdom that is coming. Now, you'll notice that, this is the last thing, you'll notice that this is largely about the church. It's not about America or Italy or Canada. It's about how we as the church are this politics, right? And I think one of the difficulties in thinking about politics is we often think just in terms of a nation. What does this have to do with real politics? You know, real politics being what we do in America. And I think somehow we need to, part of this exercise, which is talking out loud, is to get our mindset out of that and to say, no, the real politics, the first real politics, is the politics of hope. That's our first priority. It's the first most important thing we're meant to participate in, God's politics. And then, of course, we can be involved in other politics as well, which leads to the question, if the politics of hope is largely about what the church is doing, and then rejoicing when you see it elsewhere, right? Can we be involved in other politics as well? Can a Christian in the politics of hope also be a senator in the politics of America? Or are those two incongruent with one another? We'll see if we can answer that question next week and then sort of wrap up some stuff here. Okay, thanks everyone for your reflections on this and thinking out loud about it. Let's go practice it. All right, see you back in a few minutes. Oh, and get your palm fronds. Don't forget your palm fronds out there.